Well,
oh, sorry, you go first.
Go ahead. No, I think we have to be focused on vaccines and more. And this takes us back to the point we were making earlier in terms of these Caribbean countries being graduated. I think at the front of our agenda, Caribbean countries have to strengthen their resolve to place on the global agenda this whole concept of graduation, which means, in fact, we have been punished because we are trying to do a little better than we did before. We have been punished because we are doing good in terms of human development. And I think Caribbean countries have to use the COVID moment and say, look at what is happening. For those of us which are overly dependent on tourism, for example, for us to maximize the benefits from tourism, there must be a multiplier effect in the economy. Farmers and taxi drivers and vendors, there must be activity in the economy that is multiplied. But that very multiplier effect that is beneficial to the tourism sector becomes a threat multiplier for the virus. So we have to be able to say to the world, look at our dilemma. In trying to ensure that we have economic security, we are jeopardizing health security. And if we are trying too hard to promote health security, we are jeopardizing economic security. Yet you have graduated us. And you've said to us that we don't qualify because we are too rich, we are doing too well. And I think at the front of our agenda, Caribbean countries must use this opportunity, not just to reset the button in terms of our political economies and how we do tourism and other sectors of our economies, but we have to say to the world, we are vulnerable, we are susceptible, and there are complex issues that we are trying to work through. And please, but we cannot do it as individual states. This is where the regional approach becomes very critical. And I agree with both Alicia and Mohammed that we must take a regional approach to engage in the multilateral. This is where we have 14 votes, we have leverage, because the question of graduation is a serious one as we seek to get vaccines and other things that we need to get through this moment.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mohammed, you wanted to say something here also.
Yes, Dr. Grenade makes some very pertinent points. I also think that this people need to, and not just people, but rather countries and leaders, we sometimes act as if the vaccine is panacea, you know.
Right.
The vaccine has to be a part of overall a comprehensive approach. Because having a vaccine, but still having people not following protocols, still spreads the virus. And you have to not just vaccination has to be part of a overall socioeconomic plan. And again, yes, you have an individual state approach, but within the region, I'm yet to see that sort of momentum. And yes, it is difficult when you're bogged down in really tackling something that is urgent and confronting you frontally from all, you know, but yeah. I see that. I feel that the region has failed to really come together and use this to not just address COVID, but address COVID within the framework of a lot of the problems that we face in the region. And so I think that's a colossal failure. And somebody, mm-hmm. One of our countries, I hope is Barbados, takes that lead.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. This is a point I would like us to come back to as well. But we have some callers waiting to enter this discussion. So let's hear from one of them. Good afternoon. It's now 9 minutes after 12. This is Brass Tax Sunday.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes. Good afternoon to the ladies and gentlemen. This question might seem a little thing that is very important to me about the vaccination. listening to all of the work where the certain people will be selected to have it, certain countries will be selected to have this vaccination. This is my question to you all, because I am learning from you all. And this is, again, this is my question. If myself and Dennis Johnson they have a disability, and this is not only the bothers, this is the work and the care, if we were stand a chance to have this vaccination, why I'm asking this question, because as we all see and hear, I listen to everything, where the selected certain people, certain countries. I remember when they had on the polio. I can't remember how old it was or what year it was, no, because I am looking at it. But I remember early children went from the school for this vaccination against polio. I was never born. I never had a vaccination in my life, so thank God he protected me through a lot of things. So this is the question that the disability is asking me, and people is asking me, if they have a vaccination, if I will take it. But if there are limited different countries, different people selecting these things, as we all say, the most vulnerable country will not stand a chance to get this vaccination. That is all I have to say.
Okay, thank you.
I hear what I'm trying to say.
So if I can summarize what you said, one of the points had to do with whether we would have access to the vaccination because of the differences in power, if the powerful countries would hold on to the vaccines and we would have limited access. And I believe the other point was about mass vaccination. So if this is something that would be treated to like polio that was given to school age children and so on.
Yeah, what I have to understand my language. What I understand also that I remember at school in that time, I was not one to have it.
Oh, you weren't vaccinated.
Yes, I have the polio vaccination. So I am wondering if the same thing will happen to all disabled persons. Because my disability is the polio.
Right.
That is why I asked that question. So have a good day. Bye.
Okay, you have a good afternoon as well. And this is quite true. There are some people who cannot be vaccinated, even if we were to have a universal vaccination drive. And I would say it can only be a drive because I don't see that you could make it mandatory. Maybe my views are different from other people. But there are some people who cannot be vaccinated. And those who are very much supporters of vaccination argue that this is why it is very important that those who can be accept vaccinations to protect those who are unable to for varied reasons. I know the vaccination discussion will be a much larger one because there are competing views over whether we should emphasize not just this vaccine, but the variety of vaccines that people have been taking in modern times. I will not engage in that right now. I don't know if the callers want to come in on that in any way. I mean, the panelists, sorry, want to come in on that?
not that particular issue, if I may, Dr. Hines, but I just wanted to go and speak to a very important issue that the caller raised. That is not just the inequalities in access between countries, between developed and developing countries, but also within countries.
Right.
Because even within the same USA, for instance, and in other countries, the rate of vaccination among whites is higher than among minority communities. And minority communities tend to be the ones which tend to be occupying a lot of the jobs on the front lines, meaning that they're a lot more susceptible. And we have seen this in terms of the level of deaths. The rate has been higher among minority communities, particularly because they tend to, generally speaking, live in the more deprived areas and also occupy the majority of frontline jobs. Another thing is that I think this is what the caller was getting at in terms of the disabled community, whether they would be able to access vaccines on the same in the same way that the persons who are not disabled would be able to access it. So it comes back to Mr. Dega's very important point that it can't be all about vaccines. The vaccines have to be part of a broader public health initiative on how we are going to tackle this and how we are going to ensure that there's proper education, which is very important given the discussions, which I will not get into. I will not be getting into that. And also in terms of making sure that the persons who are the most in need of vaccines are able to get them.
Okay.
I understand the importance of
them. Thank you for that. Yes, go ahead, Mohammed.
Yes, just the caller raised a number of important points, one of them with respect to the which groups and who will get vaccines, etc. A point that crossed my mind when she was speaking about polio is that we forget also that there a lot of other vaccines that need to be produced and production needs to continue for those, because there are a lot of areas in the world where vaccines are still very, very critical. And COVID production requires a lot of resources, costs, expertise, etc. And the same companies, the same pharmaceuticals, the same countries which produce the other vaccines are also expending a lot of that, those resources into COVID. So what are the implications for the production and the dispersal and distribution of other vaccines in other places where they're needed? That is a very important point that many people don't, consider.
Thank you for that insight. Let's take another call. I believe we have some other callers waiting. Good afternoon. Grass Tax Hi. Sunday.
Hi, good afternoon.
Yeah. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, and thank the panelists, the lady with the foreign accent.
That's Dr. Grenade.
She
has a Caribbean accent. That's local.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's true. She made some pointers that, cannot be disputed. Every time she speaks, really, when was the first Caribbean coalition established in the 1940s or something like that?
We had the British West Indies Federation in 1958 to 62.
It was before that. Or that was the beginning of it with Mr. Adams, Sir Grantley Adams, and so on.
That would have been the official start, yes.
Yeah, and we're in 2021, right? So
yes.
The coalition don't seem to be very effective up to now. So what hinders us? As far as the question, what hinders us, and who's listening?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to kind of discuss this, please, because we can't go alone as single entities, and yet we
right.
go to the UN and those spaces as one Caribbean, and when it suits certain people, this is not good enough. We are people too over here. So I just want to hear what he needs us. And we're listening. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, too. Panelists, Dr. Grenade, I believe that was directed to you, but everyone can feel free to jump in.
Yes. Thank you, caller, for your comments and your question. When I'm asked about Caribbean integration, I usually say the glass is half full, not half empty, because I think, in fact, we have done a lot as a region, and sometimes we are very hard on ourselves. The Caribbean community have four goals in terms of economic integration, for foreign policy coordination, functional cooperation, and security. When we look at the web of institutions we have in the Caribbean, whether we're speaking about the Caribbean Public Health Institution, whether we're speaking about CEDEMA, whether we're speaking about the Caribbean Development Bank or the University of the West Indies, the Caribbean has done very well in terms of functional cooperation. We could give the world a model on functional cooperation in areas of disaster management, in areas of health, and so forth and so on. We've not done very well in terms of economic integration, because there are some concrete reasons why we produce the same things. How do you trade among yourselves when you have the same products, and so forth and so on? But in terms of foreign policy coordination, when the Caribbean countries act in unison, we have done very well and punched above our weight in the world. For many years, Caribbean countries were able to get Caribbean nationals appointed to very important international organizations. And I think we don't sufficiently count our accomplishments. And we have a culture where we sit back and say, why is it that we have not done more? But I think we have a responsibility to look at where we are as Caribbean people and ask, how do we define and present ourselves to the world? And in times when we have done so as a regional bloc, we have done well. When we think about Caribbean integration, we look at the OECS, for example, and we have a common currency. We have an economic union. There is a lot that works well. And we have to, even as we must do more, we have to look at the lessons from the past. We have to say what it is that works for us. On what areas do we cooperate best? And draw examples and move forward, knowing that regionalism is the catalyst that would propel our development. But in analyzing Caribbean integration, I think from my perspective, mm-hmm. we have done very well in terms of functional cooperation. We've had mixed outcomes in terms of foreign policy coordination. Security cooperation, there is much promise, because there are so many complex security issues. If we are to define security broadly beyond the military sphere, we would realize that we have to cooperate in terms of security. Economic integration, we need to do a lot more work in that realm. So we have accomplishments and non-accomplishments. How do we build on what works? And I think the COVID moment presents an opportunity for us to deepen regionalism. When we look at the world and we have conversations here surrounding access to vaccines and so forth, we can't go it alone. The regional approach still is the most viable approach to our sustainable development. I hope you may not agree with me, but that's my perspective on it.
Dr. Grenade, I just wanted to interject there, because while we had that caller and you were responding, there was someone else on the WhatsApp who's very pessimistic about all that you have noted. And they have indicated that we need to wake up and realize that we are a lot of talk in the region and we lack action, because some countries believe that they are better than others in the region. And this is part of our issue, part of the issue that we face in going to the United Nations, in going to the United States of America, for instance, not just in this COVID moment, perhaps to deal with the pandemic, to get access to the things that we need. And when I say the things that we need, I don't just mean vaccinations here, because across the region in Barbados, we know this very well, we're living and we feel this, but across the region, the issue is similar. Our public finances have taken a significant hit from this pandemic. Employment has taken a significant hit. Our economies are really grinding down. And I believe the person is saying that all we do is talk it real pretty, right? When it comes to speaking about regionalism, going to UN meetings and so on, but we don't really do what we need to do. What would you all say, panelists, Dr. Grenade and anyone else who wants to come in? Yes, Mohammed.
Yeah, I find it funny because I wrote my column last night instead of this morning like I would have normally done. And I actually am, it's about CARICOM and exactly what Dr. Grenade and the message from the WhatsApp raised. I am an integrationist fully. I believe in the Caribbean. And you know, I think we should be much further in the integration project. I'm more of a cynic or a pessimist. It's not from the perspective that CARICOM is not viable, but I think we have a lot more to accomplish. The accomplishments are not where they should be. I think the cooperation has occurred in spurts. There have been, you've seen some really good achievements. For example, the security cooperation during the World Cup, or sometimes when we come together on a candidature. But a lot of the times in foreign policy, we are divided. You know, it's an embarrassment when CARICOM is split on candidates presented by the international community, or when we are at the UN and we're undermining each other when we should have a central position. You know, on Venezuela, there is functional cooperation, but a lot of the times I think we function more as a regurgitation platform of documents rather than an actual substance. And I think there's a lot of work to do, but notwithstanding that, the answer to our problems in the Caribbean is regional integration, full stop.
Okay. Well, thank you. We're going to have to take a break for the news very soon. Just to let you know, though, there's quite a provocative topic I would like to bring up when we come back in from the WhatsApp, and we have some other questions. So everyone, stay with us. We're going to the news. This is Brass Tack Sunday. Good afternoon. This is Brass Tack Sunday. I am Dr. Christina Hines, and I have with me on my panel Mohammed Dege, Alicia Nichols, and Dr. Wendy Grenade. We have been discussing the new U.S. presidency's implications for the Caribbean in a COVID-19 era. And in doing this, it has really thrown up some very interesting discussions about Caribbean regionalism and its role in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic across the region, and also in terms of our relationship with the United States of America and the wider world. You may have just heard in the news that this issue of vaccines and access to vaccines and hoarding and export controls and so on is not just a North-South, a developed country, developing country kind of issue, but we're even seeing these tensions and the friction that is emerging in Europe over access to vaccines, which further will complicate what we have been discussing today. There are some interesting interventions that have come from the WhatsApp that I told the WhatsAppers that I would bring in. So brace yourselves, panelists. Here we have white supremacy. All right. So one WhatsApper has noted that the problem is white supremacy. We are talking about the importance of this U.S.-Caribbean relationship, if this new presidency will mean anything for us in the region in addressing COVID and more broadly. Some of us also may believe that having the vice president of Caribbean roots may make a difference to us. But the WhatsApper states, non-white countries are supposed to be perpetual hewers of wood and drawers of water. What happened to all this so-called goodwill from and global outrage on racism? Biden and company are just more refined racists. ask Caribbean governments to try and forge ahead in the sciences, and they would meet with the same result as they have in the offshore sector. So I guess the person is implying that if we were to produce our own remedies, vaccinations, what have you, that we would face blockages to these being viewed as acceptable in the world. And the person also suggests that the panelists read Medical Apartheid by Harriet A. Washington. Panelists, what are your thoughts on this? Is this a race issue that is intractable? Despite, no matter who makes up the presidency, will we still be left with some inequalities and difficulties in having hemispheric solutions or possibly global solutions to at least assist us with dealing with things such as COVID-19 because of a global color line? Please feel free, panelists.
Okay, I'll take that one. A very interesting perspective. I don't necessarily agree that the Biden administration has not taken any action with regard to racism, because I know that they recently Biden recently released an executive order dealing with this. Among the litany of executive orders, again, there's only so much that could be achieved through an executive order, but the fact that he made race relations one of his platforms in the campaign leading up to the election and thereafter, I do think that there is at least some goodwill on his part to one, acknowledge that there's a race issue, because that even acknowledging that there's a race issue has been controversial in the United States. There's been some divide on that issue. So I can't really agree with the, respectfully, I can't really agree with the listeners' views on that. Yes, racism is a deep-rooted problem, not just in the United States. I mean, even within our own societies here, we have our own racial tensions. It is something that is going to take not just action at the governmental level, but also at the more micro level as well. But to address the other point with regard to whether something we develop would receive the amount of support that, let's say, it would receive in a developed country, I have some empathy with the call with the listener on that argument, because we have seen that there have been occasions where we have done the exact same thing that developed countries have done, whether it's the offshore financial sector, whether it's citizenship by investment, whether it's, you know, a whole host of things, and their approach to us has been different from when they themselves do it, or when other countries similar in certain in similar economic circumstances have done it. So you know, I do think that there are some important issues that we have to think about here. And again, of course, there have been some racial disparities in terms of how the vaccine access has been rolled out in some developed countries as well. And I think that that's something that will have to be addressed. And I think that the Biden administration, given the fact that they acknowledge the importance of dealing with the race issue, that certainly it would be dealt with a lot better under them than it would have been dealt with under the previous administration.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. May I?
Yes, please.
Yes, I really want to agree with Alicia. I really want to agree with you. And I thank the caller for raising the issue. The question of racism is a global, is an epidemic that wouldn't go away. But I think we cannot, at the beginning of the Biden-Harris administration, try to analyze how it will unfold. We have to give President Biden time to lead. We have to give that administration time to deal with the domestic issues that are quite complex, including race relations, and to deal with the global issues. I think it's early days still. In fact, this is the beginning of his presidency. And we want to go in with a nuanced understanding of U.S. foreign policy, an understanding of how the world works, but give President Biden the chance to bring his own agency, his own sense of who he is, his own unique traits to the governance process. And I think it would be very unfair to the Biden-Harris administration for us at this point to be you know, just assuming that they would not do sufficient to deal with the question of race. And I'm really happy that Alicia was able to point us to the fact that he has already showed intention to deal with this domestically. The issue, I think, for many international relations scholars, they generally separate domestic issues from international issues.
Yes.
And I think it's always important to bring together the domestic and the international so that we could get the full picture. And I think domestically, we've seen a lot happening. Whether that could translate to a sort of reshaping of international relations, we have to wait to see. Yeah.